Oliver Wendell Holmes said, "One's mind, once stretched by a new experience, can never go back to its old dimensions." In this podcast, we are proud to present our guests, the world leaders and pioneers in the fields of neurointerventional surgery, interventional radiology, and endovascular neurosurgery. We will bring you through their personal journey and the three cases that have marked their professional career. From the very first to the very last case, passing by the most enriching and challenging, welcome to this original format by Link Online, my first, my last, my everything. Hi everyone, my name is Nantia Suchijantararat, and today I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Vitor Mendes Pereira. Dr. Pereira is the professor of neurosurgery at the University of Toronto. He's also director of Endovascular Research and Innovation Division of Neurosurgery at St. Michael's Hospital, Unity Health Toronto. Dr. Pereira, thanks for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me here.
So we start from the very beginning. You are here today because you are one of the leaders of our field. What path did you take to get here? Can you walk us through that a little bit?
I was born in Brazil in a city called São Luís, where I did my medical degree. And during my medical training, I was always passionate by surgery, and I had decided to do neurosurgery. And I came to São Paulo, to the University of São Paulo. And while I was doing my residency, I saw patients with stroke that had no treatment at that time. So these patients would come to emergency, we would be called to see them, and then just send them to a peripheral hospital without treatment. And in my training in neurosurgery, we were also doing interventional neuroradiology as part of the training as well. Professor Guilherme Caldas was my first mentor on angiograms and angiography, carotid stenting, and aneurysm treatment. After my residence training, I had applied to a fellowship in Paris with Professor Pierre Lajeunias in Bicêtre. So I had decided to learn more about anatomy, complex diseases. I had a passion for genetic diseases that affects the vascular system. And that was the topic of my fellowship as well. So I did a master, I did a year of fellowship. And by the end of my fellowship, talking to Professor Lajeunias, he thought that I could stay one more year. And he called his good friend, Professor Jacques Moret, to actually having me for a year at Rothschild Foundation at that time. So I had the pleasure to then continue my fellowship at Rothschild Foundation. Professor Moret was the head with Laurence Pell, Charbel Monnayer, Michel Pelletin, Raphael Blanc. It was a great group, and I had a huge experience. So I did master in surgical sciences in parallel to that fellowship. And at the end of it, I actually got appointed to be the head of interventional neuroradiology at the University Hospital of Geneva. And then my career started.
So you had the luxury of being trained by the two giants and pioneers in neurointervention. What was that like?
Yeah, I can say it was a privilege to have trained under those two practices. For my personal practice, they are very complementary. I saw vascular malformations, anatomy, pediatric practice, vascular spinal in Bicêtre, and I saw the early stages of genetic studies on vascular diseases. And then when I moved to Rothschild, I actually got to know more and use the technical tools, balloon remodeling, intracranial stents, the beginning of Onyx, and I had the privilege to have it in my fellowship. So when I started my practice, I had probably one of the most complete portfolios that you could offer as a practitioner because of the exposure to those two centers.
I know you worked in Geneva as well, so you trained in Brazil. You then went to France for more training. You then went to Geneva, and now you're at Toronto. What was that like? You are truly the world neurointerventionalist, neurosurgeon. You are the citizen of the world. What was that experience like?
Yeah, it's been a great experience. The time that we spent here in France was wonderful. Culturally, also as professionally as well. In Switzerland, for 6 years, I led the division of interventional neuroradiology, and that was a great experience. I could bring pediatric neurointerventional practice to the country. I performed one of the first thrombectomies with a stent retriever over there. We had the biggest stroke unit in Switzerland when I arrived, so I had the privilege to have already established stroke unit and vascular neurology partner. And it opened the doors for studies like STAR, that was the co-PI with Jan Grala from Bern. We were one of the pioneers of what we do today on stroke, thanks to that practice and that infrastructure as well. And also, I was able to perform the first flow diverters, silk pipeline, and I did the world first pipeline flex, and write a number of papers and start my research activity in my laboratory with computational fluid dynamics and research on imaging. So we developed a flow assessment called MAFA with Philips in Geneva in my lab. After this time, I was approached by the University of Toronto, Canada, to consider a position there at the Toronto Western Hospital by Dr. Mike Timiansky, Timo Krings, Carol Tebrug. Carol was retiring, and they wanted someone to bring clinical research, basic science research, and also advanced techniques that I was performing in Europe to North America and Canada. After some discussions, I accepted the position of associate professor initially at the Toronto Western Hospital. And just last year, I'm still at the University of Toronto, but I moved to the St. Michael's Hospital.
I know you have a lot of research efforts and projects going on currently, but just to back up a little bit, if you have to summarize your experience to date so far, you've obviously achieved a lot in your career. But if you have to pick one thing that you're the most proud of in the things that you were able to do at all these different places, what would it be?
That's hard to pick one project. I started my research lab with computational fluid dynamics, studying aneurysms, aneurysms assessment. Now we are studying veins. And because I could not bring computational fluid dynamics to clinic, I started looking for artificial intelligence, robotics, simulation for training. And actually that drove my lab to expand our scope because I could not use computational fluid dynamics clinically. So actually was probably that frustration that drove my lab. So I think the work with computational fluid dynamics, the challenge that we had to adapt the codes to process imaging, actually was the beginning of all the other activities that I perform today. And I still don't see impacts computational fluid dynamics, but I see a lot of the benefits that working with that field brought to my lab and to my career. Before we move to the other questions, I would also like to mention a research collaboration that I have with Dr. Ivan Hadovanovic, a neurosurgeon in Toronto as well, that has been studying the genetics of AVMs for years. So he described the KRAS mutations for the first time, and that is a publication that I was part of it a couple of years ago. And thanks to that work, we've been using something that Professor Lajeunie Hazen-Morey had predicted 20, 30 years ago, which is once we understand how the malformations are formed, we can target those somatic mutations. And then they potentially could be treated with medications. And we just finished our two-year patient trial that we did a feasibility of a drug called trametinib on the treatment of complex facial malformations. And the results are impressive. Mm. So this is something that is not technical, but it's thanks to the knowledge that the field from the early leaders like Professor Lajeunesse, Braca, Pica, Moret, brought to the field to now that we have the technology to look into these mutations, understanding them better. And I hope to see more and more drugs being used to treat these vascular malformations. And why not even brain aneurysms? So this is something that I foresee. The personalized medicine will be something also very present in our field in the future.
Such a fascinating topic. I can't wait to see what we'll be able to do in 10 years. Can you talk about RADIS Lab? So first off, what does that stand for?
The Rides Lab is the title of our research lab. It's managed by Nicole Cancellari, a research technologist from Canada. Eileen Liu is our research coordinator. They both help me leading the activities. And Rides Lab means robotics, artificial intelligence, dynamics, imaging, and simulation. And it summarizes the different fields that we use to tackle problems that we have in the clinical practice. So we have a clinical-oriented focus, and we use those tools to actually address precision in aneurysm treatment. That is the work we are doing now with robotics. Access to stroke, we are doing a lot of work and research in remote robotics, connectivity research, helping companies and startups on developing new robots to be able to perform more steps of the procedure so they can be deployed in really remote locations and decrease the transportation time and also improve the access. Canada, we have a vast geography. This is a real problem for us. Something that is also very present in our practice is the training. I always train fellows. In the last 15 years of my career, we have a strong fellowship program in Toronto. We have 3 clinical fellows, 3 research fellows. And by this educational activity, I started looking into AI to help improve the safety of our procedures. So we are working on AI tools to help planning and also to help the execution of procedures as if I was in the room training my fellows. I want to develop that in the future. It's one of the aims of our lab. And also apply simulation, not only on the training. I mean simulation, the true simulation that you practice your procedures. At the St. Michael's Hospital, we have beside each of our angel rooms a simulation lab with a virtual simulator and silicon model simulator that we integrating into the clinical practice for us to prepare for the procedure and for the fellows to actually improve their skills and the other fellows that were not involved directly in the clinical case to also expand their experience with learning. And we continue working with CFD, that is the dynamics of the RADIS lab. And we are now using computational fluid dynamics to predict aneurysm growth on the aneurysms that we follow up. And we also are using computational fluid dynamics to assess patients with venous stenosis that present intracranial hypertension or pulsatile tinnitus or both to actually understand how much the stenosis that they have on the venous side are impacting the circulation and also impacting the patient's quality of life. So the idea is to use that to select patients for treatment. And the last topic of our research is actually the imaging research. We have done solid work on improvement of imaging quality of cone beam CT in partnership with Philips. The technology that we will see in the next few years have been studied in our lab in the last 6 years. So cone beam CT had artifacts, movements or motion artifacts because of the nature of stroke patients that are usually often treated awake. And now also there is a trend to bring the patients to the angel room as quick as possible. So for that, we needed an improvement of the cone beam CT imaging that before was just used to rule out hemorrhages to actually be diagnostic for ischemic stroke. This month, we are finishing our 5th publication that we covered from faster scans, motion artifacts, a new path acquisition that is called butterfly, where you change the axis of the acquisition to reduce the artifacts, and also some AI improvements on the quality of the cone beam CT to get it to the level of a CT and use it as a primary imaging for stroke treatment.
There's a lot to unpack there, but I think the time probably won't allow us to go into all the interesting things that you mentioned. So I'll just say this. My mentor is Dr. Charles Matouk, who was trained by some of the same people that you worked with in Canada. And prior to coming to do these interviews, I did ask about you and whether he has anything to say. And he said you are known as being technically unbelievable in your procedures. And so, you know, I'm curious to know, as someone who's known as being technically unbelievable and someone who also utilizes to the fullest these technologies that are available, how do you see this being incorporated into the future of neurointervention, or how fellows of the next generation are being trained, and how would someone get to the place that you are by utilizing some of these things that are available to us?
Yeah, thanks Charles for this nice compliment. So he's also a great leader in the field, and he also has my admiration. I always work with, in my lab, on the simulation side, on the development of new technologies, on development of new devices. We do a lot of translational clinical research. And the simulation portion of our lab is also used to help and support development of devices to be used in our field. It helps me also getting used to the devices when I translate to clinical practice. For example, we did the world's first robotic intervention 2 years ago, and we had the robot in our lab for a year, performing procedures and experiments to set up to understand the technology and also prepare for that translation. So that helps me also become skilled and confident with the devices and procedures. And I admire a lot aviation. I think this is a field that, compared to the 50s, had evolved to a level of safety, precision, that is unbelievable. So if you think on all the transport means we have today, aviation is probably the most complex, and it's the safer. And it's all thanks to the way that they evolved. They brought technology, they adapted to the training, also to the planes. And the pilots were also trained manually. Then they evolved to a more sophisticated plane, then to a more sophisticated plane. They require a number of hours to be able to be certified in a certain plane. And this is the way I see our field in the future. I think we will use or integrate all these innovations that now are available for few centers, but we will see robotics coming more and more with next generation robots, with automated tools. We will be able to do procedures assisted and certainly safer than we are performing today. AI tools to actually monitor the procedures and help you with steps or parts of the procedure that sometimes you are not paying attention, to bring it to your attention, and then you can adapt and change like they do in aviation. And I see simulation being a big part of our lives in the future. The volume of, we know that experience changes the outcomes of patients and reduce the risk of surgeries. And today we don't have simulation at the level of aviation, but I think it's something that in the next years we will see more and more.
Let's segue into the last portion of the podcast. These are the four questions that we asked every guest. The three questions pertain to the cases that you've done. So for the first one, what was the first case you remember you did as an attending?
So I trained in many different places. So I did many cases in Brazil. I started, my first procedures were carotid stenting and some of the simple coiling or balloon-assisted coiling with Dr. Jory and Caldas in Brazil. But when I think about my first cases, I had two very important cases that I remember still. One was my first coiling when I arrived in Bicetre. I was working at that time with Timo Krinks, that was an attending there. And there was a large basilar wide neck aneurysm that we treated using two microcatheters, placing different 3D coils. And that was my first complex case and the first case that I did on a fellowship. And he did a great job teaching me how to do that technique. And it was, for me, my first case in Bicetre. And my first case in Rothschild Foundation, I was assisting Professor Moret on performing, at that time in 2007, a transvenous AVM. That fascinated me. I navigated for the first time a microcatheter under his supervision through the vein and studying the vascular anatomy and the angioarchitecture, looking from the venous side, was for me eye-opening. So I still remember that day in my first month doing and scrubbing for the first time to help him in the transvenous AVN case. So those cases were like, wow.
Yeah, very advanced for the first cases. Now, the second question pertains to the case that you feel is most challenging, most memorable, or most career changing that you remember. Do you have something in mind?
I do. And this case happened in Switzerland. I had a young patient that was getting blinded with intracranial hypertension, failed medical treatment. She also had a pulsatile tinnitus that was actually worse than the visual decline that she was presenting. And at that time, we did an assessment on the venous anatomy 14 years ago, and we saw a very narrow transverse sinus. And I considered putting a stent. I have done venous stenting for other diseases or going through the veins to treat dural arteriovenous shunts, but that was the first time that I did myself venous stenting for intracranial hypertension and pulsatile tinnitus. From that, I've been developing this field. So today, I probably perform 60 to 80 procedures on the venous side per year. And my last patient that I saw actually last week, I treated her in January with venous sinus stenosis dehiscence and a mastoid vein. And we used a set of microphones to record the noise, the sound that she was hearing. And actually, we were able to treat all these, and she's cured from the pulsatile tinnitus. And she brought me, just before I take off from Toronto here, a stone that is called Uperlite. This is a very rare stone in the Lake Superior in Canada that you have to look with a special lamp when the sky is very dark. Wow. And she brought it as a gift to me in a nice frame to illustrate for her the importance that was my role in her life, improving her care. She had pulsatile tinnitus for 6 years, depression, a lot of social issues, and today she was cured and getting her life back. And I think this practice has been interesting and changing my career practice as well.
So you just answered the last question that I was going to ask, which is, what was the last case that you did?
Oh, my last case that I did was actually a different one.
Yeah.
My last case was actually live transmitted here to the link.
Oh, yeah.
Was a robotic web. So I think one of the big advantages of the robotic today is the precision. And I did a small complex ACOM aneurysm that my colleague, Dr. Marotta, tried to embolize. Because of a fenestration, the coils were unstable. So he aborted the procedure a couple of months ago. And we have done it, a web device implantation with the robot live here on Monday. I was very happy with the performance of the robot and also with the result. Patient was discharged yesterday. And that was actually the last case I did.
Very nice. Going out with a bang, indeed. All right. The last question before we close out today is, what do you hope to leave as your legacy in the field?
So legacy is a big question. I want to be known as someone that is not complacent with the status quo, that has been looking for innovations to improve the precision, the safety of our procedures and the outcome of patients, and also to improve the care, expand the innovations and the treatments that we have today to more patients worldwide.
Dr. Pereira, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.